KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A Chinese AI company with cheaper tech that might best competitors like OpenAI's ChatGPT is causing panic on Wall Street. What does it mean for rival companies? That's coming up on Morning Edition from NPR News. Should the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks get a plea deal? I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. That's the question. Before a federal appeals court today, we hear two views from family members of people killed on 9/11. When residents fled wildfires in Los Angeles, they had to leave behind so much, including prescription medication. So where are evacuees going for medical help? Plus, why are a group of retired spies trying to block a new casino near Washington, D.C.? It's Tuesday, January 28th. Happy birthday to actor Elijah Wood. He's 43. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. President Trump's deportation effort, focusing on those in the U.S. without legal status, is continuing. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says it's made more than 3,500 arrests. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says he's sending hundreds of National Guard troops to the southern border. Gabriela Alcorta Solorio with Texas Public Radio reports.
Abbott is directing the Texas Military Department to coordinate with the Trump administration on border security, a change from the Republican governor's legal battles with the Biden administration. Abbott spent the last 4 years testing the state's ability to enforce immigration law. Now, with Trump in office, Abbott says the state will be working with the federal government. The 400 soldiers being deployed are from the Texas Tactical Border Force, established in 2023 to aid the thousands of Texas National Guard soldiers already mobilized to the border. The Pentagon announced last week that it has begun deploying more than 1,500 active duty troops to the southern border. I am Gabriela Alcorta Solorio in San Antonio.
The community of Latin American and Caribbean states is holding an emergency summit in Honduras later this week. The meeting was called after President Trump and the president of Colombia traded tariff threats over immigration and the treatment of migrants. Colombia's president eventually relented to Trump's demands, which Trump is messaging as a warning to other nations. Maria Fernanda Basmaski with the Atlantic Council's Adrian Arsh Latin American Center sees this political approach as risky.
I think that the Trump administration is betting on a coercion strategy that will yield results in the short term, but is not sustainable in the long term. Latin American and the Caribbean countries have other options other than the United States, and so the administration has to really balance out those sticks and carrot approach.
Basmaski spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Stocks open mixed this morning as the Senate confirms President Trump's pick to lead the Treasury Department. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow slipped about 40 points in early trading.
Scott Bessent won bipartisan backing in the Senate. As Treasury Secretary, he'll be a leading salesman for the president's economic policies, including an extension of the 2017 tax cuts. New orders for long-lasting manufactured goods fell last month, largely because of a sharp drop in commercial airplane orders. Stripping out the volatile aircraft category, durable goods orders were slightly higher. A cargo vessel traveling through the Red Sea suffered an explosion today, forcing the crew to abandon ship. A lot of cargo traffic's been bypassing the area to avoid attacks by Houthi rebels in Yemen, although the rebels had promised to halt those attacks following the ceasefire in Gaza. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News from Washington. The Senate is expected to vote today whether to confirm Sean Duffy as Transportation Secretary. Also happening this week, confirmation hearings for Health Secretary nominee Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Kennedy has faced criticism over his skepticism of vaccines, among other controversial viewpoints. A new survey finds the vast majority of parents still have positive views of childhood vaccines, although vaccine confidence is falling among Republicans. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports.
Among all parents, 82% say they keep their child up to date with recommended childhood vaccines. That's according to a survey published Tuesday by KFF, a nonpartisan health research organization. The survey of 1,300 adults was conducted earlier this month. However, trust in vaccines overall has fallen since the COVID-19 pandemic, especially among Republicans. Among Republican parents, more than one in four say they have skipped or delayed vaccinations for their kids. That's double the percentage it was just 2 years ago. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
The Grammy Awards are being revamped to raise money for wildfire relief in Southern California. The Recording Academy and its affiliated charity launched a fund to help those affected by the catastrophic fires. And many in Hollywood have canceled Grammy parties and other events. The award show is being held in L.A. on Sunday. The three largest wildfires are more than 95% contained, and rain has now moved out of the area without major mudslides that were anticipated. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, could a proposed casino near Washington, D.C. be a security risk? Some former intelligence officers are raising concerns.
We begin, though, with a small Chinese company that might be about to burst Silicon Valley's AI bubble. The company is called DeepSeek, and it even caught President Trump's eye.
The release of DeepSeek AI from a Chinese company should be a wake-up call for our industries that we need to be laser-focused on competing to win.
The product was made on the cheap and is set to rival tools from companies like OpenAI, which created ChatGPT. In response to DeepSeek AI's release, tech stocks plummeted around the world. So, is this company and its creation a threat to the United States' multi-billion dollar AI industry? To dive into what DeepSeek did and what it means, we've got Matt Sheehan with us. He researches AI and China at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Good morning, Matt. Thanks for being on the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, what did this company do that U.S. companies like OpenAI and Google, what they haven't done yet?
DeepSeek's model essentially matches OpenAI's most recent model in terms of performance. But the surprise and the challenge comes from the fact that they did it so quickly, so cheaply, and so openly. So quickly in terms of they were able to match OpenAI's performance within just a couple months after the OpenAI model was released. Cheaply in terms of spending far less computing power to train the model, with computing power being one of, if not the most important input during the training of an AI model. And openly in the sense that they released this essentially open source online so that anyone around the world can download the model, use it, or tweak it, which is much different than the more closed stance that, ironically, OpenAI has taken.
And why did we see stocks react this way and really the companies here in the U.S. kind of freak out?
The fact that DeepSeek did this so quickly and specifically openly, releasing it open source, is really a challenge to the business models that a lot of people have imagined for AI going forward. That includes for the companies that are trying to build and then sell access to their models. And it also includes the stocks of chip companies, semiconductor companies like NVIDIA. Mm-hmm. The assumption beforehand was that you need tons and tons, you know, tens if not hundreds of millions of dollars spent on access to chips in order to reach this kind of frontier of AI performance. DeepSeek has shown that you can achieve that for much cheaper, and that's got people nervous about the stocks of companies like NVIDIA. And it's also representing a challenge to companies like OpenAI, or you could say Google with Gemini, any other frontier AI company that's trying to sell access to its model globally.
I mean, how did this Chinese company do this, especially given that the Biden administration had banned the best AI microprocessors from being sold to China?
Ironically, those things might actually be quite interconnected in that the Biden administration's export controls on the chips used to train AI have essentially backed Chinese companies into a corner. They are not entirely cut off from access to these chips, but they have much lower supplies. And so it's forced them to get very creative in how they can squeeze as much efficiency as possible out of those chips. And in that process, they've done it much cheaper, which led to the result here.
Do you think there are going to be some similar concerns from U.S. officials around this company over national security that we saw over TikTok because it is owned by a Chinese company?
Yes, almost certainly. And that kind of comes in and from a few different angles. You have the quite direct concern about data privacy, about whether or not, you know, Americans interacting with, say, the DeepSeek app, whether or not their data is going to China and then could be accessed by the Chinese Communist Party. But you also have the more sort of macro level concern about what does this say about where the US and China stand in the race or the competition to build the most powerful AI systems.
Matt Sheehan is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, specializing in artificial intelligence and China. Thank you, Matt, for your time.
Thank you.
Should the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 terror attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, be allowed to get a plea deal? That question goes before a federal appeals court today. NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer will be there listening to lawyers for both sides make their case. She's also been asking 9/11 victim family members what they think.
Brett Eagleson of Connecticut and Terry Rockefeller of Massachusetts each had a loved one die in the World Trade Center collapse. Eagleson lost his father, John. Rockefeller lost her only sibling, her sister Laura. Both want to punish the men responsible, but they disagree on how to do that. Here's Brett Eagleson.
We want a trial. We want to put these individuals on a stand. We want the public to see everything that these individuals have to say.
So he was disgusted when the U.S. military court at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, announced that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would plead guilty and spend life in prison rather than face a death penalty trial. Two alleged accomplices also agreed to plea deals. The exact terms are sealed. And Eagleson wants to know, for example, if the men would be allowed to eat and pray together as they now do at Guantanamo.
There are prisoners that are pleading guilty to the mass murder of 3,000 Americans. I think that they should get absolutely nothing that they want.
He also believes secrets could come out at trial, like details about financing the attacks. And he's not satisfied by government assurances that as part of the plea deals, the prisoners would be required to answer questions by 9/11 family members.
I think the idea that we're going to gain more information is a bunch of BS. They're trained liars. They're going to lie.
But Eagleson realizes the 9/11 case may never go to trial. That's partly because the defendants were tortured, which has compromised evidence like confessions. So he says he would support plea deals if the U.S. government makes public all the material it's gathered in the case, even classified material.
So I think one of the conditions of a plea deal would be to share the evidence with us so we know the history and it's not swept under a rug.
Otherwise, Eagleson says, he wants a trial. But Terry Rockefeller, whose sister died on 9/11, believes continuing to push for a trial is futile. She was at Guantanamo this month when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's attorney said his client is ready to plead guilty.
And it was so tantalizingly close to actually having the confession.
But it didn't happen. A federal appeals court halted the guilty pleas. That's because former U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin tried to reverse the plea deals last summer. Whether or not he can do that will be argued in federal court today. To Terry Rockefeller, it's more futility.
Sisyphus, pushing the boulder up the hill, just getting so close and then having to take so many steps backwards again. Then it was very painful.
She worries if the 9/11 case keeps getting delayed, the defendants will die in prison legally innocent. So she thinks plea deals are the only way to resolve the case, something the military court has been unable to do.
I thought it would put an end to the totally failed military commission system.
And Terry Rockefeller and Brett Eagleson both say it appalls them that the U.S. government has allowed the 9/11 case to drag on for more than two decades.
This is not a legal criminal trial. This is a political trial down here.
Sasha Pfeiffer, NPR News.
And now for a bit of spycraft.
More than 100 retired spies have written a letter about a possible new casino in the Washington, D.C. area. They say it could pose a threat to national security.
The group has among them literally hundreds of hours of experience. We're not a group of NIMBYs masquerading as spies.
By NIMBY, she means not in my backyard. That's Ann Gruner, who co-chairs the group National Security Leaders for Fairfax. She also spent 25 years at the CIA.
In the course of all that, seen all kinds of security issues, problems with drinking, problems with people doing things they shouldn't do. I mean, good people get into inadvertently.
The casino would be built in an area of Northern Virginia that's also home to the CIA, Director of National Intelligence, and the National Counterintelligence and Counterterrorism Center, along with defense contractors and the Pentagon.
Gruner says easy access to a nearby casino could lead people to develop an issue with gambling, which could be exploited by foreign adversaries.
These employees would become the focus of any intelligence collection and could become susceptible to extortion.
However, not everyone is convinced.
About 60% of my docket is related to security clearances. How people obtain them, how they maintain them, how they lose them, and then how they get them back.
Dan Meyer is a partner at the Tully Rinke Law Firm. He specializes in military and security clearance. He says there are clear and extensive guidelines developed over decades that people need to follow in order to get and keep clearance.
I call them the samurai code of the federal workforce.
Plus, he says there are checks in place to flag issues related to gambling. If you win more than $10,000 in a casino, an email is automatically sent to your security officer through the Financial Crimes Reporting Center. And there's already a casino about 10 miles from the White House.
So if you have a great day at MGM Grand over there at National Harbor and you win $10,050, Monday, you're going to be in talking to your security officer, and they're going to ask you about your behavior and whether everything is all right.
So reasonable people can differ, but perhaps we can agree that this sounds like a great spy series just waiting to be written.
Or the name's A. Layla, capital A. Martina.
Corny.
From Morning Edition with Love, this is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, our guest will be Amani Perry, author of the new book, Black and Blues, How a Color Tells the Story of My People. She's a Harvard professor and MacArthur Fellow, and her previous book, South to America, won the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2022. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com. From the estate of Jane Gross, whose bequest supports NPR's commitment to creating a more informed public by distributing programming that meets the highest standards of public service and journalism. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Millions of Palestinians live in exile, many of them in refugee camps in neighboring countries. At one camp in Lebanon, Palestinian women have set up an embroidery workshop to preserve their culture from afar. NPR's Lauren Freyer went to visit.
So we have two machines here.
Women hunch over sewing machines with one eye on the colorful thread they're weaving through black linen cloth and another on their mobile phones showing footage of Israeli airstrikes in Gaza. The seamstresses in this workshop are second and third generation Palestinian refugees, born in Lebanon but still treated as outsiders. And their trade, traditional Palestinian embroidery called tatriz, is one of the ways they connect to their homeland. Hanan Zarura is the chief designer, and her life story of displacement and loss mirrors that of modern Palestinian history.
Latest from Palestine, heavy damage in and around the Arab city of Jaffa.
In the 1948 war over Israel's founding, Zarura's parents were displaced from the land their ancestors had farmed for centuries. They fled north, crossing into Lebanon. Zarura still has their passports.
This is an entry stamp from...
Her parents were herded into a refugee camp called Shatila in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. That's where Zarura was born. She grew up in the shadow of her parents' trauma and then experienced her own. In 1982, amidst Lebanon's civil war and an Israeli invasion, local militias allied with Israel killed hundreds of civilians in the camp.
The Palestinians are terrified of more killings. Men, women, and children fled Shatila this morning.
Zarura remembers militiamen going door to door, rounding up local men and shooting them. They killed her father-in-law, and then they came for her husband. I thought they might have mercy on him if he had a baby, so I put our 2-year-old in my husband's arms, and it worked. But years later, her husband was killed in another round of fighting in the camp. And Zarura found herself a widow with 4 children by then. She turned to the traditional tatriz embroidery she'd learned as a girl, both for a livelihood and as therapy. Every Palestinian region has its own unique design. And Zarura, who has never been anywhere in the Palestinian territories, nevertheless knows them all. She's become a master craftswoman of this art, which has become a symbol of resistance and identity for Palestinians everywhere. The United Nations has recognized tatriz as an intangible piece of cultural heritage. And in the year 2000, Zarura was finally able to lay eyes on her homeland. On a trip to the Lebanon-Israel border, for the first time she met her aunts who still live on the other side. They asked an Israeli border guard to pass a piece of jewelry across the border fence.
This ring? This one?
Wow, hello.
Yeah. This is from Palestine.
It's a gold ring made from what looks like a spoon from their old house, to which Zarura still has keys. A Jewish Israeli family is now living there. Zarora grew up with her parents' trauma, but she also grew up with their stories about what they described as coexistence between Jews and Arabs in what was then called Palestine before 1948. The olives of Palestine were shared among everyone back then, she says. Now, as a refugee in Lebanon, she can't buy property. And so she hunches over her needlepoint in a rented workshop in this infamous camp, singing a Palestinian ballad. About a homeland she's never set foot in. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, in the Shatila refugee camp in Beirut.
A school shooting in Nashville, Tennessee, has reignited calls for gun reform. Students once again marched at the Tennessee State Capitol yesterday, days after a student at Antioch High School fatally shot a classmate and himself. As Mariana Bacchiao of member station WPLN reports, the shooting comes less than 2 years after another tragedy unfolded at the Covenant School.
The chants, the signs, even some of the faces in the crowd are the same as 2 years ago. But this time around, demonstrators are less optimistic. A groundswell movement for gun reform after the Covenant School shooting in 2023 did not sway Tennessee's Republican supermajority.
We're not naive.
That's Drew Spiegel, a sophomore at Vanderbilt University and a survivor of a 2022 mass shooting in Highland Park, Illinois.
We know that the odds are stacked against us. We know that Republicans in this state, a lot of them have no intentions of making our community safer.
Since Spiegel first started demonstrating at the Tennessee Capitol in 2023, the House has blocked off half the gallery seats from the public, and the Speaker now has the power to ban spectators from the State House for up to 2 years for disruptive behavior.
Until the last year or two, this has really not been an issue.
That's House Majority Leader William Lamberth. Earlier this month, he explained why the rule was necessary to a group of reporters.
There are 10 or 12 people that like to go up into the gallery and holler and shout little insults and cause a scene and make it all about them.
Last time the State House saw a crowd this big showing up for gun reform, it was because Tennessee Governor Bill Lee had called a special session to address concerns after the Covenant School shooting. This week's special session is all about school vouchers, disaster relief, and immigration enforcement.
Are they going to be doing anything about the guns?
No!
No, because they'd rather attack our immigrant and refugee neighbors.
Governor Lee says he wants Tennessee to be ready to help with the president's mass deportation efforts.
What I believe is that President Trump was elected saying what he wanted to do, and the people elected him in a very strong fashion, and I'm supportive of his strategies going forward.
Members of Nashville's Latino community say the timing is rough. The father of Jocelyn Correa Escalante, the student killed at Antioch High School last week, says he fled from Guatemala to give his daughter a chance at life free from violence. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacallao in Nashville.
This is NPR News.
In the 1960s, the Navy built undersea habitats hundreds of feet below the surface and sent aquanauts down for a look.
None of this had ever been done before. We all felt like we were their lab rats, but we were all young and thought we were invincible.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, the forgotten history of the Sea Lab Project on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. At least a dozen officials at the Justice Department who worked with Special Counsel Jack Smith have been fired. NPR's Kerry Johnson says those let go worked on two cases brought by Smith against Donald Trump.
Acting Attorney General James McHenry did not cite a cause for the firings. Instead, he wrote the new Trump administration could not trust those workers to carry out the president's agenda because of their significant role in prosecuting Trump. Many of the people who were fired by email are longtime civil servants with job protections that allow them to appeal and sue over their dismissal. Any financial settlement with them would be covered by taxpayers. Justice Department veterans who spoke with NPR could not cite another instance in modern DOJ history where an entire group of prosecutors was dismissed for their work on a particular case. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
The cases brought by Smith were dismissed after Trump won a second term in the White House in November. One stemmed from the January 6th attack at the U.S. Capitol. The other involved Trump's handling of classified documents after leaving the White House. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt holds her first briefing of Trump's second presidency this afternoon. At age 27, she's the youngest person ever to serve as White House Press Secretary. This is NPR News. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is allowing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to return to northern Gaza. It's also enabling people to look for the missing and the dead in areas previously off limits, as NPR's Aya Batraoui reports from Gaza.
Across Gaza, people are returning to cities in ruins, with most buildings damaged or destroyed overwhelmingly by Israeli airstrikes. Now that the bombs have stopped, people are searching for their loved ones. Zaki Shakber says he identified his nephew's body recently from his clothes and shoes. Local officials say there's no capacity to run DNA tests now in Gaza. Another man, Ali Ashour, says he's searching all morgues for his mentally disabled 18-year-old son, who's been missing for 9 months. I want my son. I hope he's detained with the Israelis. I want him home, he says. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, with reporting by Anas Baba in Gaza.
The conference board says consumer confidence in the U.S. is down for the second consecutive month. Separately, orders for durable goods in the U.S. fell 2.2% in December. It's the sharpest drop in 6 months and marks back-to-back monthly declines. Stocks on Wall Street are higher this morning following a day of sharp declines for tech stocks. The Nasdaq lost more than 3% yesterday. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C. Good morning. This week is tariff week, if President Trump does what he forecast. The president said he was likely to impose tariffs on products from Canada, Mexico, and China on February 1st. That's this Saturday. Two of those countries are the United States' neighbors, and then there's China, one of the U.S.'s biggest trading partners and rivals. Steve Inskeep got a perspective from there.
That perspective comes from Qian Lu, who lives in Beijing. She's an economist and a writer who has worked advising global businesses. I first met her last year during a visit to the Chinese capital, where she spoke of how the economy has been struggling since the pandemic. We called her back to ask what shape China's economy might be in for an emerging trade war. The government has been trying to stimulate economic growth for the past year or so. How is that working?
If you look at the official Chinese GDP numbers, it's worked miraculously. The government issued a series of stimulus package from the second half of September, and already we just had the announcement that the 2024 Chinese GDP last year achieved target for exactly 5%. Although a lot of people feel there is a big gap in terms of the actual day-to-day lives.
You mean people's lives are not reflected by the numbers the government is putting out?
Yes, in the sense that people don't feel the economy is growing at 5%. On top of that, the unemployment rate is much higher than before, and especially for young people. So this is quite worrisome. There's another very important factor, which is the wealth effect. When the real estate was growing in the past several years, that means even if you weren't working, even if you weren't doing anything, every day you were becoming richer than the day before. So you had a very solid wealth effect for you to have the confidence to spend the money. But nowadays, your income is not growing as fast. Your unemployment probabilities is increasing a lot, and your wealth effect is no longer working.
The Chinese government has put a lot of emphasis and enormous investment in trying to dominate what it sees as industries of the future: wind power, solar power, electric vehicles, electric batteries, various kinds of high tech. Are those investments paying off?
They're definitely paying off in terms of how much China is leading, if not dominating, certain factors and industries in the world. But the world is getting more and more cautious of that, and China is learning to be more and more mindful of how other countries are reacting and giving feedbacks to that.
What do you mean by other countries being cautious? Mean worried about Chinese power?
So take electric vehicles, for instance. Many countries have looked into this and trying to put a new ban or very high tariffs on China. So China knows that this is coming.
So President Trump has talked of imposing tariffs on China broadly on February 1st. Do Chinese exporters assume they will pay that extra cost, which is what Trump says, or is this a cost they can pass on to Americans who buy their stuff?
Of course, ultimately, it's the consumer that always paid the final price. Now, China does give a lot of subsidies, so the Chinese government would pick up a portion of this, but that would be trivial when it compared to really, it will be ultimately the American consumers that will be paying for this.
So it raises the price of products that China sells in the United States. American consumers pay more. Presumably that means they buy a little less. Is China ready for that shock or pressure or disappointment, whatever it turns out to be?
I will first challenge the notion that if people will be spending more. In theory, yes, when a price goes up, then you buy less. But in practice, that doesn't happen all the time. It is very, very difficult to find top quality products and with very, very affordable prices that China has managed to produce. Part of that is how China has created a very comprehensive supply chain. And that economy of scales is something that no other country in the world is able to compare and compete. I travel to some of these coastal provinces in China where they do a lot of clusters of manufacturing. It's amazing how, say, all of a sudden you need a particular kind of screwdrivers, and you can just call the suppliers. They will be able to deliver it to your door with their own trucks within 20 minutes. Again, it's the very comprehensive and scalable supply chain that China has.
Well, Chandler, it's a pleasure talking with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's an assessment from China, one of many we're sure to hear from both sides of the ocean if U.S. tariffs do take effect.
When the wildfires struck Los Angeles, people had to leave their homes so quickly that many of them left behind medical necessities, things like prescriptions and inhalers, things that can be really hard to replace. NPR's Alejandra Borunda went to a pop-up event where evacuees could get the medical help they needed.
Dora Alman had lived in her Altadena home for 53 years before the Eden fire came raging through.
My husband decided at 9:30 that it was time to go, and so I had 5 minutes to get everything together.
They took almost nothing.
The things that we were wearing, essentially, is all we took.
And the next morning, she realized something.
And I left my glasses, my latest glasses, at the house.
Dora's daughter, Christina, couldn't get her an appointment for new glasses until late February. So when they heard that there'd be a team at this health event that could do eye exams and grind lenses for glasses on demand, they got straight in the car and drove over.
And here they are. Aren't they beautiful? Yes. Doesn't she look great?
It's not just glasses.
We understand that a lot of patients can't get into their primary care doctor.
That's Carla Rugamas. She's a nurse with the nonprofit Vita Mobile Clinic.
They lost their medication, so this is a place, a safe space, where they can come in, get their refills.
And it's not just medications. They pulled together a clothes donation and veterinary care to help animals who had evacuated. Like Mitzi, the 14-year-old Yorkie, and Leia, the heavy-breathing French bulldog.
Thank you.
There were also mental health professionals at the event. They just wanted people to know that they're available to help in English, Spanish, and other languages for free whenever people feel ready.
We know that patients are going to need help, not just today, next week, next month, but the years to come.
Kennedy Kasky works for the healthcare support organization AmeriCares. It supported the event. Kasky deploys all over the country after natural disasters, which she knows are getting more intense because of climate change. Scientists determined the LA fires were more likely and more intense because of it.
Climate change is an ever-evolving thing and getting worse and worse. And so this past year, I mean, I've only had a 6-week break or 8-week break since Helene.
But it only takes one disaster to upend people's lives, like for Dora.
According to my husband, it's time to downsize, and nature took care of that.
But at least now, she has glasses to help her see where she's going next. Alejandra Borunda, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Meet a blind runner who created a program to train dogs to be running guides. That's next time, here and now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin. When you order something online, you expect to actually get the physical item. But when Sylvester Franklin ordered tools to his Georgia home from a China-based online retailer called Alibaba, he got a printed photo of the drill he paid for. He was also expecting the pressure washer he paid $22 for. Instead, he got a screw. Franklin's been asking for a refund since November. Still no luck. I guess the screw was a message. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Charles Schwab, offer investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at Mott.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Rebel fighters, who are now part of Syria's new de facto government, have been seizing and burning large shipments of Captagon. That's the addictive amphetamine drug that was mass-produced and sold by the old ousted regime. Syria's new rulers want to show they're making a clean break with the past. NPR's Emily Fang followed along as one batch was destroyed.
It was mid-afternoon on a dreary Damascus day when we suddenly got a call. Fighters with Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, the rebels that toppled the former regime, were about to destroy several tons of Captagon and other drugs. So we hop in the car and head towards the plumes of heavy black smoke billowing from the dry hills around the city. A lot of smoke. NPR producer Jawad Rizala explains HTS soldiers had chosen a symbolic site to destroy these drugs.
This is near the headquarters of the 4th Division.
The 4th Armored Division, a branch of Syria's military overseen by the younger brother of Bashar al-Assad, the country's ousted dictator. He was sanctioned by the U.S. for his ties in producing and smuggling Captagon and other illicit drugs. Now the new rulers of Syria want to destroy it all on this barren hilltop right in view of the 4th Division headquarters.
Don't breathe. Try not to breathe.
We see bright orange flames coming out of a pit, and nearby, two tall piles of plastic sacks of some kind of white powder beginning to catch fire. They fill the air with putrid smoke. Usama Aldami is an anti-narcotics officer with the HTS government.
This is the raw material that is used to produce Captagon.
The precursors for Captagon.
He says he discovered this batch of Captagon and precursors during a raid that very day in a factory linked to the 4th Division. The factory's owner had already fled Syria. Aldami says he's burning these amphetamines because they're poison. Their trade turned Syria into a narco state, bringing in billions of dollars in annual revenue for the former regime. In the last month, Aldami says he has personally overseen the destruction of 60 tons of illicit drugs seized from former regime entities. Nearby, more HTS soldiers are dismantling a pile of auto parts.
But he's taking it open. And inside are the pills.
They are pills of Captagon and tens of thousands of tabs of an expired painkiller hidden in these auto parts to smuggle them out of Syria. Mohammed Noor is another HTS fighter. He motions us to the biggest bonfire of all.
So behind me you can see just this open fire pit where they've thrown in the barrels of Captagon and set it on fire to destroy it. It's been going for a while now, so it's just mostly ash.
The remains of dozens of blue barrels once full of Captagon. Noor says they've been burning for nearly a week now. He says even he's been a little surprised at how much they've found. He also seems a little surprised at how quickly everything has changed. Just a few weeks ago, he was fighting the Assad regime. Now, on a high ridge overlooking Damascus, he is destroying the drug that financed it. First, he has to keep this fire going. And it's going to be burning for a long, long time. Emily Fang, NPR News, Damascus.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez.
freeze on all federal grants and loans.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at Viking.com. And by Glassdoor. Adam Grant has joined the Glassdoor community with expert advice on finding a job and making the most of work life. Learn more at Glassdoor.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. The Trump administration is ordering a temporary pause of all federal grants and loans. It takes effect at the end of the day. The order came yesterday in a memo from the Office of Management and Budget. As Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports, it leaves a lot of questions unanswered.
The memo says taxpayer dollars should be spent on things like energy and manufacturing, and their money is wasted on things like, quote, Marxist equity and transgenderism. It also says Medicare and Social Security benefits will not be impacted, and neither will, quote, assistance provided directly to individuals. So, will USDA loans to Black and Native American farmers be frozen? Another question, is this legal? Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer doesn't think so. He sent out a statement last night saying the Trump administration must reverse course immediately, adding that Congress approved these investments and they are not optional, they are the law. The memo does say that federal agencies should cancel awards in conflict with administration priorities, quote, to the extent permissible by law. They have to submit detailed information on any program subject to the pause by February 10th. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
JetBlue reported this morning that its operating revenue in the fourth quarter was down slightly, but in general did better than expected. Boeing, on the other hand, reported its revenues were down 31% compared to a year prior. And that kind of encapsulates the state of the air travel industry. Airlines are all right, but other corners of the industry are weighing them down a little bit. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
Airlines have been doing well, with Delta, United, and American delivering strong results.
The demand picture is healthy.
Mike Stengel at Aerodynamic Advisory says overall U.S. air travel now exceeds pre-pandemic levels. The major airlines are earning more on premium seats and destinations, and airfares are up about 8% year over year.
A lot of the revenge travel is behind us. We still see carriers getting creative, like United launching service to Greenland and Mongolia.
The big problem is on the supply side for aircraft and labor, says Nicholas Owens at Morningstar.
Trouble at Boeing and similar backups on Airbus planes. There's also a shortage of air traffic controllers.
That makes it hard for airlines to add new aircraft and flights. Mike Stengel at Aerodynamic Advisory says they're flying older planes, driving up maintenance costs. He predicts Boeing and Airbus won't catch up to pre-pandemic production levels until 2028. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is up 250 points, that is 0.6%. The S&P 500 up 0.6%. The NASDAQ is up a full percent. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.574%. The chances of getting a fat raise are getting a little slimmer in 2025. That is according to a new survey from Gartner. The percentage of CFOs who said they were going to raise average compensation by 4% or more went from 86% in 2023 to just 61% this year.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto. Learn more about bundling at progressive.com. And by Amazon Business, focused on offering smart business buying solutions, leading time to focus on growth. More at amazonbusiness.com. And by Rubrik, dedicated to giving businesses the power to bounce back fast when cyber attacks target the cloud. More at Rubrik.com.
The rules of Congress are Byzantine and seemingly endless. And with the start of the new Congress and administration, a rarely used rule has come out of the woodwork. It's something called the Congressional Review Act, and it could allow Republicans to roll back some, but not all, Biden-era rules and regulations. Marketplace senior Washington correspondent Kimberly Adams is here to break it down. Good morning.
Good morning.
Remind us, what is the Congressional Review Act?
It's a law from 1996 that allows Congress to overturn rules and regulations issued by the last administration with just a simple majority in both houses plus the president's signature. But it kind of takes a unique situation. You need to have a flip of control of the White House plus control of both houses of Congress by the new president's party. That's been a relatively rare scenario since the CRA became law, but Trump has had this situation both times he entered the White House.
We have already seen the Trump administration rescind some Biden rules and regulations via executive order. But what sorts of policies might be at risk because of this CRA?
So there's a look back window in terms of how far back Congress can go to undo regulations. And it goes back to around August of last year. George Washington University's Regulatory Studies Center has been tracking which of Biden's rules and regulations could be subject to the CRA, and the team there figures there are about 1,300 rules that Congress could target, although only about 100 or so are viewed as significant. Sarah Hay is a policy analyst there, and she gave me a few examples.
There's a EPA rule targeting methane emissions, and then also EPA's rule telling water systems to remove all lead pipes in the next 10 years. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's rule that's prohibiting creditors from considering medical information.
But of course, it's up to members of Congress which, if any of these, they're going to prioritize.
Well, is there anything to stop Congress from just rolling back everything?
Well, I mean, time is a big one. In addition to that limited look-back window, each rule or regulation they want to overturn has to be handled separately. They can't just bundle a bunch of them together. And floor time in Congress is pretty limited. But the bigger issue is that if Congress uses the CRA to cancel out a policy, it means the affected agency can never issue a similar rule. Here's Sarah Hay at the Regulatory Studies Center again.
And so if there's a subject that an agency regulated on and Congress is thinking about overturning it, but then they might say, oh, but maybe we want to issue a regulation on that ourselves in the future.
And so to preserve that option for the future, members of Congress may want to leave it to the executive branch to tweak a regulation rather than completely throw it out.
All right. Marketplace's senior Washington correspondent Kimberly Adams, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.